Chapter 3, The Recognition. From this intense consciousness of being, of severe and universal observation, the wearer of the scarlet letter, so Hester Prynne, was at length revealed by discerning, out of the outskirts of the town, a figure which irresistibly took possession of her thoughts. An Indian in his native garb was standing there, so in his native clothing, but the red men were not so infrequent visitors of the English settlements they visited often, that one of them would have attracted any notice from Hester Prynne at such a time, much less would have excluded all other objects and ideas from her mind. By the Indian's side, and evidently sustaining a companionship with him, stood a white man, clad in a strange disarray of civilized and savage costume. So he was wearing some Indian clothes, some white people clothes. He was small in stature, with a furrowed brow, which as yet could hardly be termed aged. He wasn't that old. There was a remarkable intelligence in his features, as of a person who had so cultivated his mental part that it could not fail to mold the physical to itself and become manifest by unmistakable tokens. Although by a seemingly careless arrangement of his heterogeneous garb, he had endeavored to conceal or abate the peculiarity, it was sufficiently evident to Hester Prynne that one of the man's shoulders rose higher than the other. Again, at the first instance of perceiving that thin face and the slight deformity of the figure, she pressed her infant to her bosom with so convulsive a force that the poor baby uttered another cry of pain. But the mother did not seem to hear it. So all of her energy, all of her attention is now on this guy that's standing at the back of the crowd, to the point where she instinctively and out of her control, like, squeezed the baby to her so hard that it cried out. At his arrival in the marketplace and sometime before she saw him, the stranger had bent his eyes on Hester Prynne, so he's looking at her pretty carefully, too. He was carelessly at first, like a man chiefly accustomed to look inward and to whom external manners are of little value and import, unless they bear relation to something within his mind. Very soon, however, his look became keen and penetrative. A writhing horror twisted itself across his features, like a snake gliding swiftly over them and making little pause with all its wreathed involutions and open sight. His face darkened with some powerful emotion, which nevertheless he so instantaneously controlled by an effort of his will that save at a single moment its expression might have passed for calmness. So he, like, looked horrified for just a moment, and then he got control of his face again. After a brief space, the convulsion grew almost imperceptible and finally subsided into the depths of his nature. When he found the eyes of Hester Prynne fastened on his own and saw that she appeared to recognize him, he slowly and calmly raised his finger, made a gesture with it in the air, and then laid it on his lips. Think about that gesture, guys. Then, touching the shoulder of a townsman who stood next to him, he addressed him in a formal and courteous manner. "I pray you, good sir," said he, "who is this woman, and why is she set up to here on the scaffold?" "You must needs be a stranger in this region, friend," answered the townsman, looking curiously at the questioner and his savage companion, "else you would surely have heard of Mistress Hester Prynne and her evil doings. She has to raise a great scandal, I promise you, in goodly Master Dimmesdale's church." "You say truly," replied the other, "I am a stranger, and have been a wanderer, sorely against my will. I have met with grievous mishaps by sea and land, so everything went wrong, and have been long held in bonds among the heathen folk, so the Indians have kept me captive to the south, and am now brought here by this Indian to be redeemed out of my captivity, so somebody's going to pay him ransom. Will it please you, therefore, to tell me of Hester Prynne, I have her name rightly, of this woman's offences, and what have brought her to yonder scaffold?" "Truly, friend, and methinks it must gladden your heart, after your troubles in sojourn in the wilderness," said the townsman, "to find yourself at length in a land where inequity is searched out and punished in sight of rulers and people, as here in our godly New England. Yonder woman, sir, you must know, was the wife of a certain learned man, English by birth, but who had long dwelt in Amsterdam, whence, some good time ago, he was minded to cross over and cast his lot with us in the Massachusetts. To this purpose he sent his wife before him, remaining himself to look after some necessary affairs. Mary, which is kind of like swearing, good sir, in some 2 years or less that the woman have been a dweller here in Boston, no tidings have come of this learned gentleman, Master Prynne, and his young wife, look you, being left to her own misguidance." So let's sum that up there, ladies and gentlemen. So Miss Hester was married to some guy, a learned gentleman, so a scholar of some kind, in Amsterdam, so across the Atlantic Ocean in Europe, and they decided to move to America, and she came first, and he was going to follow her, but it's been 2 years since then, and there's been no sign of him. He has just disappeared off the face of the planet, and somehow she's gotten pregnant and had a baby in the meantime. "Aha! I conceive you," said the stranger with a bitter smile. "So learned a man as you speak of should have learned this too in his books, and who, by your favor, sir, may be the father of young babe. Is it some 3 or 4 months old, I should judge, which Mistress Prynne is holding in her arms?" "Of a truth, friend, that matter remaineth a riddle, so we don't know who the father is. And Daniel, who should expound it, is yet a wanting," answered the townsman. "Madam Hester absolutely refuseth to speak, and the magistrates have laid their heads together in vain. Peradventure the guilty one stands looking on at the sad spectacle unknown of man, and forgetting that God sees him." So the guy says, you know, irony says that the guilty person, the father, stands looking in this crowd somewhere. "The learned man," observed the stranger, with another smile, "should come himself to look upon the mystery. So Hester's husband, who has been absent all this time, should be in the crowd himself to see what's going on. It behooves him well if he still be in life," responded the townsman. "Now, good sir, a Massachusetts magistracy, bethinking themselves that this woman is youthful and fair, and doubtless was strongly tempted to her fall, and that, moreover, is as likely her husband may be at the bottom of the sea, they have not been bold to put in force the extremity of a righteous law against her. The penalty thereof is death. But in their great mercy and tenderness of heart, they have doomed Mr. Sprint to stand only a space of 3 hours on the platform of the pillory, and then and thereafter for the remainder of her natural life to wear a mark of shame upon her bosom. So they could put her to death for having sex and getting pregnant by somebody else, but they're so nice, they're only going to embarrass her forever." "A wise sentence," remarked the stranger, gravely bowing his head. "Thus she will be a living sermon against sin, until the ignominious letter be engraved upon her tombstone." So even in death, she's going to have this letter on her grave. "It irks me, it makes me angry, nevertheless, that the partner of iniquity should not at least stand upon the scaffold by her side. So the father, the baby daddy, should be there up with her. But he will be known, he will be known, he will be known." He bowed courteously to the communicative townsman, and whispering a few words to his Indian attendant, they both made their way through the crowd. While this passed, Hester Prynne had been standing on her pedestal, still with a fixed gaze toward the stranger. So she's staring at him through this whole conversation. So fixed a gaze that at moments of intense absorption, all other objects in the visible world seemed to vanish, leaving only him and her. Such an interview perhaps would have been more terrible than even to meet him as she now did, with the hot and middle-day sun burning down upon her face and lighting up its shame, with the scarlet token of infamy on her breasts, and with the sin-born infant in her arms, with a whole people drawn forth as to a festival, staring at the features that should have been seen only in the quiet gleam of the fireside, in the happy shadow of a home, or beneath a matronly veil at church. Dreadful as it was, she was conscious of a shelter of the presence of those thousand witnesses. It was better to stand here with so many people between him and her than to greet him face to face, they two alone. She fled for refuge, as it were, to the public exposure, and dreaded the moment when its protection should be withdrawn from her. Involved in these thoughts, she scarcely heard a voice behind her until it had repeated her name more than once in a loud and solemn tone audible to the whole multitude. "Hearken unto me, Hester Prynne," said the voice. It had already been noticed that directly over the platform on which Hester Prynne stood was a kind of balcony, or open gallery, appended to the meeting house. So there's a church right above where she's standing, and there's a balcony off the church, and there's a guy standing on the balcony. It was the place where proclamations were made amidst an assemblage of the magistracy. So people stand there and sometimes give sermons or sometimes make announcements, with all the ceremonial that attended such public observance in those days. Here to witness the scene which we are describing sat Governor Bellingham himself, with 4 surgeons about his chair, bearing halberds as a guard of honor. He wore a dark feather in his hat, a border of embroidery on his cloak, and a black velvet tunic beneath, a gentleman advanced in years, so very old, with a hard experience written in his wrinkles. Not a nice guy. He was not ill-fitted to be the head and representative of a community which owed its origin and progress in its present state of development not to the impulses of youth, but to the stern and tempered energies of manhood, and the somber sagacity of age, accomplishing so much precisely because it imagined and hoped so little. The other eminent characters by whom the chief ruler was surrounded were distinguished by a dignity of mien belonging to a period when the forms of authority were felt to possess the sacredness of divine institutions. So in order for you to be in power, you had to have God's blessing on you. They were doubtless good men, just and sage, so they should be fair. But out of the whole human family, it would not have been easy to select the same number of wise and virtuous persons who should be less capable of sitting in judgment on an erring woman's heart and disentangling its mess of good and evil than the sages of rigid aspect towards whom Hester Prynne now turned her face. She seemed conscious, indeed, and whatever sympathy she might expect lay in the larger and warmer heart of the multitude, for as she lifted her eyes toward the balcony, the unhappy woman grew pale and trembled. So as she looks to who's standing up there on the balcony, she gets really nervous again. The face which had called her attention was that of the Reverend and famous John Wilson, the eldest clergyman of Boston, a great scholar, like most of his contemporaries in the profession, and withal a man of kind and genial spirit. This last attribute, however, had been less carefully developed than his intellectual gifts, and was in truth rather a matter of shame rather than self-congratulation within. There he stood, with a border of grizzled locks of gray hair beneath his skull cap, while his gray eyes, accustomed to the shaded light of his study, were winking, like those of Hester's infant, in the unadulterated sunshine. He looked like the darkly engraved portraits which we see prefixed to old volumes of sermons, and had no more right than one of those portraits would have to step forth, as he now did, and meddle with a question of human guilt, passion, and anguish. "Hester Prynne," said the clergyman, "I have striven with my younger brother here, whose preaching of word yon have been privileged to sit." Here Mr. Wilson laid his hand on the shoulder of a pale young man beside him. "I have sought, I say, to persuade this godly youth that he should deal with you, here, in the face of heaven, and before these wise and upright rulers, and in hearing of all the people, as touching the vileness and blackness of your sin. Knowing your natural temper better than I, he could the better judge what arguments to use, whether of tenderness or terror, such as might prevail over your hardness and obstinacy. Insomuch that you should no longer hide the name of him who tempted you to this grievous fall. But he opposes to me with a young man's over-softness, albeit wise beyond his years, that it were the wronging of the very nature of woman to force her to lay open her heart's secret in such broad daylight and in the presence of so great a multitude. So this guy, John Wilson, is trying to persuade the young guy next to him to try to persuade Hester to tell the name of the father of the baby. But the young guy says, no, 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 that's not right. It's wronging the very nature of woman to force her to lay open her secrets. Truly, as I sought to convince him, the shame lay in the commission of the sin, and not in the showing of it forth. What say you to it, again, Brother Dimmesdale? So that's the young guy next to him. Must it be you or I that shall deal with this poor sinner's soul? There was a murmur among the dignified and reverent occupants of the balcony, and Governor Bellingham gave expression to its purport, speaking in an authoritative voice, although tempered with respect toward the young clergyman whom he addressed. "Good Master Dimmesdale," said he, "the responsibility of this woman's soul lies greatly with you. It behooves you, therefore, to exhort her to repentance, and to confession, as proof and consequence thereof." The directness of this appeal drew the eyes of the whole crowd upon the Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale, a young clergyman who had come from one of the great English universities, bringing all the learning of the age into our wild forest land. His eloquence and religious fervor had already given the earnest of high eminence of his profession. He was a person of very striking aspect, so he's handsome, with a wide, lofty, and impending brow, large, brown, melancholy eyes, and a mouth which, unless when he was forcibly compressed, it was apt to be tremulous, expressing both nervous sensibility and a vast power of self-restraint. Notwithstanding his high native gifts and scholar-like attainments, there was an air about this young minister, an apprehensive, a startled, a half-frightened look, as if being who felt himself quite astray and at a loss in the pathway of human existence. It could only be at ease in some seclusion of his own, so he gets nervous around people. Therefore, so far as his duties would permit, he trod in shadowy bypaths, and thus kept himself simple and childlike, coming forth when occasion was with a freshness and fragrance and dewy purity of thought, which, as many people said, affected them like a speech of an angel. Such was the young man whom the Reverend Mr. Wilson and the Governor had introduced so openly to the public notice, bidding him speak, in the hearing of all men, to that mystery of a woman's soul, so sacred even in its pollution. The tying nature of his position drove the blood from his cheek and made his lips tremulous. "Speak to the woman, my brother," said Mr. Wilson. "It is of moment to the soul. Therefore, as the worshipful governor says, momentous to thine own, in whose charge hers is, exhort her to confess the truth. Tell her to confess. Make her confess. The Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale bent his head in silent prayer, as it seemed, and then came forward. "Hester Prynne," he said, leaning over the balcony and looking down steadfastly straight into her eyes, "you hear what this good man says, and you see the accountability under which I labor. If you feel it to be for your own soul's peace, and that your earthly punishment will thereby be made more effectual to salvation, I charge you to speak out the name of your fellow sinner and fellow sufferer. So if you think that it's going to do any good, you should say his name. Be not silent from any mistaken pity and tenderness for him. For believe me, Hester, though he were to step down from a high place and stand you there beside you, on your pedestal of shame, yet better it were so than to hide a guilty heart through life. What can your silence do for him, except to tempt him, yea, compel him, as it were, to add hypocrisy to sin? Heaven hath granted you an open ignominy, that thereby you mayest work out an open triumph over the evil within you and the sorrow without. Take heed how you deny to him, who perchance had not the courage to grasp it for himself, the bitter but wholesome cup that is now presented to your lips." The young pastor's voice was tremulously sweet, rich, deep, and broken. The feeling that is so evidently manifested rather than the direct purport of the words caused it to vibrate within all hearts and brought the listeners into one accord of sympathy. Even the poor baby at Hester's bosom was affected by the same influence, for it directed its hitherto vacant gaze toward Mr. Dimmesdale and held up its little arms with a half-pleased, half-plaintive murmur. "So it didn't like anybody else, but as soon as Mr. Dimmesdale started to speak, it's all like, 'Hey, look at me, I like you!'" So powerful seemed the minister's appeal that the people could not believe but that Hester Prynne would speak out the guilty name, or else that the guilty one himself, in whatever high or lowly place he stood, would be drawn forth by an inward and inevitable necessity and compelled to ascend the scaffold. Hester shook her head. "Woman, transgress not beyond the limits of heaven's mercy," cried the Reverend Mr. Wilson, more harshly than before. "The little baby had been gifted with a voice so second and to confirm the counsel which you had heard. Speak out that name. That and your repentance may avail to take the scarlet letter off your breast." "Never," cried Hester Prynne, looking not at Mr. Wilson, but into the deep and troubled eyes of the younger clergyman, so Reverend Mr. Dimmesdale. "It is too deeply branded. You cannot take it off me, and would that I might endure his agony as well as mine." "Speak, woman," said another voice, coldly and sternly, proceeding from the crowd around the scaffold. Somebody from the crowd is now yelling at her. "Speak, and give your child a father." "I will not speak," answered Hester, turning pale as death, but responding to this voice, which she too surely recognized. So she just recognized the voice of whoever was just yelling at her. "And my child must seek a heavenly father. She shall never know an earthly one." "She will not speak," murmured Mr. Dimmesdale, who, leaning over the balcony with his hand upon his heart, had awaited the result of his appeal. He now drew back with a long respiration, so a deep breath. Wondrous strength and generosity of a woman's heart. "She will not speak." Discerning the impracticable state of the poor culprit's mind, the elder clergyman, who had carefully prepared himself for the occasion, addressed to the multitude a discourse on sin in all its branches, but with continual reference to the ignominious letter. So forcibly did he dwell upon this symbol for the hour or more during which his periods were rolling over the people's heads, that it assumed new terrors in their imagination, and seemed to derive its scarlet hue from the flames of the eternal pit, so it's red because of hell. Hester Prynne, meanwhile, kept her place upon the pedestal of shame with glazed eyes and an air of weary indifference. She had borne that warning all that nature could endure, and as her temperament was not of the order that escapes from too intense suffering by a swoon or fainting, her spirit could only shelter itself beneath a stony crust of insensibility, while the faculties of animal life remained entire. In this state the voice of the preacher thundered remorselessly, but unavailingly, upon her ears. The infant, during the latter portion of the ordeal, pierced the air with its wailings and screams. She strove to hush it, so she tried to shut it up, mechanically, but seemed scarcely to sympathize with its trouble. With a safe, hard demeanor, she was led back to the prison, and vanished from the public gaze within its iron-clamped portal. It was whispered, by those who peered after her, that the scarlet letter threw a lurid gleam along the dark passageway of the interior. So the scarlet letter is kind of glowing as she's walking in the dark.